8. You've been listening to Press Watch on 90.7 FM on our big transmitter on the West Hills, and you've been listening on KBLO.FM, and in that manner we go out to you, to all the ships at sea.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Then we walked back to the road, unchained.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Tuesday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the third annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride at 8 p.m. on January 8th at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main in downtown Portland near the Schnitzer. More information can be found on the KABU website under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fargering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is Professor Stephen Cohen, who is a professor emeritus of Russian history at New York University and Princeton University, a nation contributing editor and author of several books. And the one we're going to talk about today is War with Russia? Question mark. So, Professor Cohen, welcome to KABU.
Happy to be with you. Thank you.
Well, let's get right into this. You say in your book that this new Cold War, I remember the old Cold War, and it was pretty dicey at times, but you say the new Cold War is more dangerous than the last.
So let me explain. I wrote this book, War with Russia? Question mark, and the subtitle captures the period during which I wrote it. From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. I began writing the book when the Ukrainian crisis began in 2013, and the book is pretty up to date. It ends at the end of 2019. There are a lot of different subjects in the book, most of which would be familiar to readers, and this is for general readers, not for my scholarly colleagues, and I should say most of them don't agree with me. But the overarching themes of the book are, we have been in a new Cold War with Russia for quite a long time. I dated back to the 1990s, but it certainly became evident with the Ukrainian crisis in 2013, and it continues today. And as you said, and it's always important to remember generations in our country. Sometimes I talk to young people who actually do not remember or were born after the first Cold War ended. born, like my daughter, who was born in 1991, we can't automatically assume that they remember what we remember. But we are in a new Cold War. It has its different characteristics, though it's unfolding at a pace that makes it seem increasingly like the old Cold War. But I make a second argument, and that this new Cold War is more dangerous than the one we survived. There's a certain complacency, even among people who understand it's a new Russian-American Cold War, as well, we survived the first one and we'll muddle or manage through this one. But what I argue in this rather small book in various places is the new one is very, very dangerous in ways the old one was not. And in one small chapter, I give nearly 10 reasons, but let me just cite two, because those of us who remember the old Cold War will immediately see the difference. This one is unfolding politically, not in Berlin, as the old one did in the late 1940s and onward, far from Russia, far from what was then the Soviet Union. This one is unfolding militarily right along Russia's borders, from the small Baltic nations and Poland, where NATO is perpetuating a reckless and major military buildup, all the way down to Ukraine on Russia's borders. And everybody's familiar with the headlines. But there's a second element. For reasons that I cannot fully explain but need to be discussed, during my lifetime, American presidents were encouraged to negotiate with Soviet communist leaders to keep us safe from war. It took the form of nuclear arms agreements. It took all sorts of collaborative efforts to guard against war. Now we have a situation where the leader of Russia, the Kremlin leader, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, is so demonized in the United States that when President Trump, for example, attempts to meet with him at a summit and Trump comes home, it's called treason. So where does that leave us? If it's true we're in a more dangerous Cold War, but this American president, and I think it's going to be true of the next one too if this continues, is not permitted to carry out the kind of what we used to call detente or anti-Cold War negotiations with the Kremlin, where does this leave us? And I would argue in a more dangerous place than we've ever been. So that's the overarching theme of the book. Though a lot of episodes, Russiagate, various political actors in the United States, Putin, other countries appear in the book. Those are the two overarching themes.
Well, we also have, you mentioned in your book, that both sides are seeking what they call usable nuclear weapons. And this is, seems to me, this is a very dangerous concept, that nuclear weapons can be used.
And isn't it interesting? I don't know, per your age, but I remember vividly when I was growing up in Kentucky, by the way, in the 40s and 50s, that the danger of nuclear weapons in war was constantly on our minds. It was always in the news. It was the subject of novels and movies. The dangers of a nuclear holocaust triggered by war. This rather vanished from American, at least, popular culture and political discourse when the Soviet Union ended in 1991, as though with the Soviet Union the nuclear weapons went away, but they didn't. And one of the things that's unfolded under the kind of headline radar, though it's been noted by very important American nuclear scientists such as Professor Theodore Postol at MIT, and not only Ted Postol, is that both sides, but it was driven by the Americans, and I can explain why, have sought to make smaller, more precise nuclear weapons, weapons whose radioactive fallout can be controlled, and they openly say that these are more usable. So we've come from, for example, President Reagan's statement that nuclear weapons must never be used. That's what animated his famous negotiations with the last Soviet president, Mikhail Gorbachev, both of whom feared nuclear weapons in a very visceral way, to discussions today about the glories of these new weapons, which are usable. It began briefly maybe it didn't begin, but it was unleashed when President George W. Bush, so unwisely, took the United States in 2002 out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. You remember that that treaty banned the United States and Russia from deploying anti-missile defenses. Each got one. I think Moscow deployed it in Moscow, or Russia did. I'm not sure where we deployed ours. But generally, missile defense was banned because both sides needed to remember that if either launched a first strike, the other could and would retaliate completely, which would mean mutual destruction. And that kept us safe. Once Bush took us out of that treaty, unilaterally, to the great grief of the Russian leadership, and the United States began to deploy missile defense systems along Russia's borders on land and sea, the Russians began to try to develop weapons that could elude missile defense, and they have. Putin announced them, this is in the book, by the way, on March 1st, 2018, and no one, it seems, except myself, because I published that short part of the book in The Nation right away back in March, until recently at the end of 2018 when Putin again mentioned these weapons and said they had been deployed. Meanwhile, the American nuclear military industry has told us not to worry because they're developing a new generation of nuclear weapons that can, you know, destroy those that can now elude our defenses. So, in plain language, we have the dialectic already unfolding of the previous nuclear arms race, where each side responds to the other. And we thought that had been ended by Reagan and Gorbachev, or many people did, 30 years ago, but it hasn't. And that's another reason why things have become so dangerous. There's very little, remember the old, do you remember the anti-nuke grassroots movement that played such a large role in American politics?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's gone. It's gone. I haven't heard a word of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because public consciousness has been lulled into the, and this is at least since the Clinton administration, that nuclear weapons are no longer a danger because the Soviet Union no longer exists. And yet we villainized Putin in a way, in ways more ferociously than we villainized Russian communist leaders, but the dots haven't been connected yet, though I think they soon will be.
I was going to ask you about that. Why are we? Why is Putin so demonized? It's just hard for me to figure out.
Well, the first thing that somebody who claims to be an expert should say when they don't know is, "I don't know," but I think about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I've discussed it with people who see what you and I see, that why has this, I would say, fairly traditional, successful at home, Russian leader been so demonized in ways that, for example, Khrushchev and Brezhnev were not demonized when Eisenhower and Nixon were dealing with him on a regular basis. A twofold explanation comes to mind, but it's clearly not a full explanation. And some people would say, no, you need to be more profound, that there's a permanent war secret state in Washington that wants to build weapons, needs an enemy, and it's always going to be Russia because Russia is the handiest enemy and we have the legacy of the Cold War, so it's easy to reactivate fear of Russia. But I think it's something a little more. When the Soviet Union ended in 1991, and you may remember this, and many of your listeners may remember, we were told by the Clinton administration for nearly a decade during Bill Clinton's two terms that Russia, then headed by its president, its first post-Soviet president, Boris Yeltsin, was now, and I quote, America's strategic friend and partner. And this was told to us and shown to us on television repeatedly during Clinton's 8 years in power, in the presidency. When Yeltsin quit or was forced out due to, he was very ill and he was a bad drinker and he had heart problems, And Putin was put in place. This was at the very end of 1999, and then Putin was elected president in March 2000. There was an expectation, because Yeltsin had appointed Putin, that Putin would be, as the New York columnist Nick Kristof said, a sober Yeltsin. That is, that Putin would continue in this new practice of Russia of being subordinate to the United States in world affairs, and at home too. And when Putin turned out to be someone very different, representing different forces and perspectives in Russia, not only in the Kremlin, someone who was going to set Russia on a course of rebuilding itself and of an independent role in world affairs, there was outrage in the American political media establishment. And instead of understanding the dynamics of what had happened in Russia with Russia's collapse after the end of the Soviet Union, they blamed Putin. Bad Putin, good Yeltsin. And you still see this today, sometimes in the mainstream media, this nostalgia for Yeltsin and this hatred of Putin. So in a way, it could be this, that when the Soviet Union ended, there was the widespread assumption in Washington that we would now have a one-polar or unipolar world, with the United States being the pivot of world politics and development. And then suddenly Russia is back on its feet, and that imagination didn't play out. But instead of analyzing what happened, instead of analyzing what's happened in other places in the world, in what we used to call the Third World, or the BRICS nation, or China, and Russia's role there, it was easier to do an analysis that Putin was a bad man. He was aggressive, he was a Soviet man, he killed people, none of which is true. He's not a paragon of virtue, but he's a very interesting Russian and international leader. But it was easier, rather than rethink what had been thought in Washington, just to blame Putin. That's not the entire explanation, but I think it belongs among, say, the two or three factors that we have to consider to explain this extraordinary demonization of a Russian leader who's not a communist, who's an anti-communist, who says he's a capitalist. What's going on here? I try to treat that in the book, whether I succeed in persuading readers, but at least I think in the book I provide an alternative way of thinking about these events that have brought us where we are today, and readers will either accept my perspective, but at least I hope they will rethink the ones they read in the mainstream media, or at least that's my hope.
Well, you know, one of the things you hear about Putin is he's supposed to be, I think somebody actually calls him the richest guy in the world. He's supposed to have this vast wealth, you know, yachts and palaces and whatever. And it occurred to me is, when does he get to enjoy all this vast wealth?
Well, he certainly works hard, and it's not clear how long he sleeps, because he does a lot of things. He travels a lot. But I don't know the answer to that question, except one part of it. When we're shown videos of Putin moving around Russia, and when we, if you're in Russia and you see the coverage of him there, you see, as you say, opulent dachas and resorts and planes and ships and the rest. The short answer is those belong to the state. And any president of Russia would take control of those during his presidency of Russia. That is, those are what are called государственные, state assets, presidential assets. So this would be like saying, well, where did an American president get the wealth to buy Air Force One, or all those helicopters, or Camp David? This comes with being president of Russia, which, by the way, since the end of the Soviet Union, has been rather modeled on the American model of the presidency, that a president should have at his disposal, along with these multiple security operations, all these conveniences and luxuries that enable him to be president 24 hours a day. As for Putin's personal wealth in bank accounts or personal possessions, I don't know. It's certainly been true that every Russian leader since after Gorbachev, who did not do this, since the end of the Soviet Union, has enriched himself tremendously. And this is not only the president, but the entire top elite. The extent to which Putin has done so, I do not know. And I would imagine he is a very wealthy man. But the talk of being the wealthiest man in the world certainly is not true.
Well, let's talk about the oligarchs. You know, it sort of seems to be assumed that all the oligarchs are kind of part of Putin's gang or something, but the oligarchs actually began under Yeltsin.
Well, that's right, and the most rapacious ones, because they were looting the country in the 1990s under Yeltsin, excuse me, and the backlash against the oligarchs, who had been looting the country on their own or in cahoots with Western corporations, including American ones and American banks, offshoring their wealth. A backlash against that is what created Putin. There's just no question about that. And that even though a handful of Yeltsin oligarchs put Putin in power in 1999 and 2000, thinking they would be protected by Putin after Yeltsin, they were half wrong in that, and we have the famous meeting where this took place. Putin said, you can keep your wealth. We're not going to look into how you got it. But henceforth, you are going to pay your taxes. You're not going to offshore your wealth. You're going to keep at least a significant portion of your wealth, and certainly the natural resources, in Russia, because these are the assets of the Russian people and the state. Putin has been, his record on this is interesting. The offshoring and corruption, the looting of Russia, has more or less ended. I say more or less, substantially. But along the way, Putin has created his own elite of oligarchs whose loyalty is primarily to him and not to the Yeltsin era, though those Yeltsin oligarchs also remain. And what he said is, obey the law, continue, keep your wealth, but play by the rules of the state, which means above all, pay your taxes and invest in Russia. And those who have prospered under Putin have done that, though they have wealth abroad. But it's also the case that when Putin has special projects that require billions of dollars, I'll give you two examples. The Sochi Olympics in 2013-2014 required, as I recall, about $50 billion to build the infrastructure in Sochi. He told the oligarchs, okay, this is your project. I want you to finance this. And they did. And when he built the quite remarkable bridge, which recently opened, from mainland Russia to Crimea, the Kerch Bridge, and you'll remember that on November 25th, there was shooting between Ukrainian and Russian gunboats near that bridge. But that bridge was very expensive, and it's not done yet. The automobile part is open. The rails, the train rail part, will open, I think, in about 6 or 7 months. It was fiercely expensive. But again, Putin turned to oligarchs to fund it. So it's kind of old Russian tradition, and it goes back to the czars, that the privileged aristocracy, in terms of wealth, maintains its position by serving the state when necessary. It's a Russian tradition. Is it a bad tradition? Is it a good tradition? Is a different point. But we see Putin, who's extremely interesting, operating within the context of three traditions: the czarist tradition, the Soviet tradition, and the first post-Soviet tradition after Yeltsin. And it's a balancing act for him. I mean, they have to write a history, they have to have a popular culture that encompasses all these traditions, but the finances of the country draw on these traditions as well. One thing is a postscript here, is when the American sanctions began against Russia in 2013-14, and we continue to sanction them, but nobody knows why we're sanctioning them. It's become like road rage now, these sanctions. We get angry with Russia, we say, okay, here's some more sanctions. They went from sanctioning, the United States did, though the European sanctions as well, from sanctioning large Russian corporations and state entities to sanctioning individual oligarchs. And this benefited Putin enormously in this sense. He has unsuccessfully, in the last 7 or 8 years, tried to get these oligarchs to bring home much of their offshore wealth. And now that these oligarchs fear that that wealth could be frozen by Western authorities due to the sanctions, they have begun to bring it home. I saw a figure the other day, I don't know if it's accurate, but $90 billion in the first half of 2018. So the sanctions, though they've caused pain in Russia and complications in terms of investment, have made the people we call oligarchs, maybe that's not the right word anymore, but these are very wealthy people who operate in the area between the private market and the state and benefit from what's available in that area to them, made them more, not less, dependent on Putin. And the irony is, the political logic, Congress told us, of the sanctions was to make the oligarchs turn against Putin. And it said just the opposite of that.
I want one last question. Just got a couple minutes left. You know, there's so much talk now about how crazy President Trump is. And my concern is that when and if Trump is removed from office, that we will, everybody will breathe a big sigh of relief, and we will kind of follow along with the, well, supposedly more sane warmongers, and there might be even more danger war with Russia.
So you asked me a question that affects a very thin and fragile space that I've occupied in the last 4 or 5 years. I've been close to The Nation magazine for a very, very long time, which is, of course, a magazine of the progressive liberal left of the American center. And in fact, my wife, Katrina Vandenhoevel, is the publisher and editor of The Nation. So I'm tied to The Nation community, but much of the community that The Nation represents has bought into these Russiagate allegations against Trump, that he was somehow under the sway of Putin and the Kremlin. In the book, I explain why I find no credible evidence for that. But you raise a question that worries me, that the Democratic Party has bought into this Russophobia. That's what it is today, a Russophobia. That's been generated partly by Putin, but now most of all by Trump, who said he wanted to cooperate with Russia. I didn't vote for Trump. Most of what he does and says, I do not agree with. But from the beginning, which means when he became a candidate, I supported his call for cooperation with Russia, because that's what we call detente in the 20th century. That's what kept the Cold War from becoming a hot war. And that's the policy we need. So like you, I ask myself, when Trump is no longer president, will the next president, whether that person be a Democrat or a Republican, but this is particularly a problem if it's a Democratic president, will they carry on with this Russophobic policy that they've adopted against Trump? And it's serious. And as Democrats now announce their candidacy, as Senator Warren did, but we know 4 or 5 others are already running, some of them older, some of them younger, I want to hear what the Russia policy would be. And what we hear thus far is not good, not safe. So on this one issue, I give Trump a lot of credit, that for whatever reason, and even his withdrawal of American troops from Syria was so wise, because that was a tripwire. Russians are fighting there, Iranians are fighting there, 2,000 American special op forces. What difference could they make? None. They were simply a tripwire. If any of them had been killed by Russian or Iranian forces, we'd be in war. So getting them out of there sooner rather than later was a very good idea. But the Democrats are all opposed to it. Why are they opposed to it? Because they're anti-Trump.
Well, I think that is really a grounds for concern. And Our time is up. We should go on longer. We've been talking with Professor Stephen Cohen, who's the author of his most recent book, is War with Russia, a question mark. So thank you very much for being with us.
My thanks to you. Best wishes in the new year.
I hope we have a good new year, better than the last one. Thank you very much. Stay tuned to KBOO. It's your radio station. Coming up at 10 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. So stay tuned.
And you've been listening to Fight the Empire with Per Fagering. A full archive of this show, the full audio will be available on the website later today, kboo.fm/fighttheempire. As Per said, Flashpoints is coming up next, and at 11 on Between the Covers, it's a conversation with author Leland de la Durante about his new book, Hannah Versus the Tree. At 11:30, Black Book Talk shares their current reading lists, including We Should All Be Feminists, Tears We Cannot Stop, How Not to Get Shot, and Other Advice from White People, and more. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Thank you so much to all our members and everyone who gave during the Give Guide. In December, we did meet our goal. It's 10 o'clock, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland,